of land use challenges. And I think municipalities are the ones who are rightly authorized to handle those issues. And my biggest concern is that the people who are exposed to the hazards and harms of fracking are being disenfranchised and marginalized from power structures to make decisions about those risks. So I'll leave it there.
My name is Mark Truex, and I'm Director of Operations for Coloradans for Responsible Energy Development, or CRED, based out of Denver, Colorado. Appreciate the opportunity. I'm going to start two things kind of slightly different. One, I'd be remiss on OU Texas Week and having a captive audience to not say go Sooners, number one. But more specifically to our topic today, Tripp didn't even know he was going to help make my point in his opening remarks. And he called it a fracking well and said that millions of Americans live within a mile or so of a fracking well. There is actually no such thing as a fracking well. There are wells that have been fracked, and there are oil and gas wells, but there's no such thing as a fracking well. Fracking is a type of technology used to do oil and gas development. And I tell you that and point out, and Tripp, thank you for helping make my point this morning and highlight what we do at Coloradans for Responsible Energy Development. But we look at it and go, all right, how do we make sure we get the right information across? We were started in August of 2013. This was after Longmont, Colorado happened, and a ban passed in Longmont in November 2012. And the oil and gas industry was staring for either bans or moratoriums on fracking in four municipalities, in Boulder, in Broomfield, Lafayette, and Fort Collins, and in November of 2014. The oil and gas industry came together and said there is an unbelievable amount of misinformation in Colorado, including fracking wells and fracking towers and things of that nature. And by no means am I a technical expert, but I am good at listening to the technical experts to say, all right, at least know it's not a fracking well. It's an oil and gas well that we have to frack. But Anadarko and Noble came together in mid-2013 and said we have to do something different. We're losing the conversation with the opposition. There's an incredible amount of misinformation out there. And the oil and gas industry's idea of responding was, read this 50-page white paper, and it will tell you everything that you need to know. I will tell you, even as a geek and a political science guy myself, I'm not going to read a 50-page white paper to understand what we're looking at. So they created Coloradans for Responsible Energy Development, brought in myself, my boss, our campaign manager, Paul Phillips, and a team of national experts on messaging, on strategy, to really understand and be able to highlight and educate the oil and gas process in Colorado. We have done, over the last 2 years, extensive amount of research as to, all right, how do Coloradans want to receive their information? What do they want to know? In November of 13, in a series of focus groups we conducted, we had, all right, asking basic questions. How deep does fracking go? What's in fracking fluid? Talk to me about the air quality, the water quality, and how and what goes in to protect that. Is the industry regulated? Believe it or not, most Coloradans we found do not believe that the oil and gas industry is regulated, even though there are countless local, state, and national regulations on the oil and gas industry. So as people are asking those questions, we went, well, what if there was a website designed to answer some of those questions and provide information? And so that night, studyfracking.com was born, if any of you have been to that website previously. And that ran for about a year and really had a lot of our information on it. We've brought that now into cred.org and a lot of the information that we've had there. But everything we do is footnoted, is cited, is referenced. I feel like I'm writing a political science paper all over again whenever I write a press release or a mail piece or something of that nature, because we want to make sure that our facts are accurate and that people know, all right, if I say this, it's not just Mark Truax making a claim. Here's the EPA report. Here's the report from the University of Colorado Lead School of Business on the jobs and what the oil and gas industry brings to the economy. And we have had tremendous success at changing the conversation in Colorado, beginning to drive our discussion and make sure that Coloradans have, you know, kind of the factual information, and we're getting them the information that they're looking for in a very strategic way. So we're looking forward and moving forward into 2016, moving into year three of Coloradans Responsible Energy Development, what that holds, if there's going to be any ballot activity. And I'm happy to go into the ballot measure language that was in 2014 that was withdrawn. So we're evaluating what's going to happen next. And at this point, it's anybody's guess. There's been a couple of measures that have already been filed with the Secretary of State's office for 2016, but that deadline's coming up on April 8th for submission to Secretary of State for consideration on that November 16 ballot. So a lot of fun happening in Colorado. It's been a great ride. I look forward to your questions here just a little bit.
Thank you. My name is Arnella. As Tripp said, I'm with the Oklahoma Oil and Gas Association. The Oklahoma Oil and Gas Association, formerly known as the Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association, is actually the oldest energy trade association in the United States. It was started in 1917 by names you're probably familiar with, former Senator Robert S. Kerr, the founder of Phillips 66, other founders of Kerr McGee, very steeped in Oklahoma history and energy history. In Oklahoma, similar to what Adam talked about happening in Texas, Oklahoma legislature this year passed exactly that, a preemption bill. Oklahoma, that was Senate Bill 809. In fact, it has, since it has been in effect, several state legislators have submitted questions to the Attorney General. So Oklahoma's Attorney General Scott Pruitt is actually reviewing those questions. We've yet to get a response from him, but those have to deal with several things that were in the bill about whether or not, this was not addressed in the bill at all, but whether or not current regulations that communities have, cities and towns have, could be grandfathered in. And then particularly defining what public health and safety means. So in Oklahoma, the preemption bill said, you know, localities, counties, you know, local cities and towns could not ban hydraulic fracturing and oil and gas processes unless, you know, it was in an effort for public health and safety purposes. The bill did not go on to define that. In fact, the bill itself is probably a page and a half, so not very detailed. So that is why there are several in the industry, and those, you know, who have concerns about oil and gas operations are awaiting an opinion from Oklahoma's Attorney General before we go into the next legislative session. In Oklahoma, a little bit similar to Texas, you know, there is, being a conservative state, local control is usually the favored option. Of course, there are plenty of times Oklahoma's Republican legislature goes a different direction, opposite of local control. An example, they passed a preemption on minimum wage. They were scared to have, you know, Oklahoma City or Norman or different communities passing, you know, various minimum wages at different rates. That's a problem for business and trying to compete even within the state, much less with our neighbors. So even though local control is a popular theme in Oklahoma, Oklahoma really comes down to always present in our capital are personal property rights. In Oklahoma, your land ownership is tied to those mineral and water rights beneath you. So most people in Oklahoma, you know, that have been landowners, particularly for, you know, a couple generations, receive royalty payments from oil and gas operations, whether vertical or horizontal drilling. So those that have advantages from hydraulic fracturing, I mean, they're getting a check every month if they have active drills. Of course, in Oklahoma, like across the United States, we are down about 57% from where we were a year ago in terms of active rigs in Oklahoma. In terms of other policy issues, kind of outside of, you know, fighting over whether or not hydraulic fracturing is a good thing, in Oklahoma, we are trying to update our statutes. This has been going on probably since 2012. So for the last 3 years, we have been trying to allow multi-unit drilling in Oklahoma, similar to what North Dakota has done and has helped their boom in that state. But in Oklahoma, again, kind of going back to that local control and personal property rights issue, we have a history of independent producers. And of course, they really rely on vertical drilling. You may have participated in the earthquake panel, I think that happened yesterday. A.J. Ferrati, who is the regulatory affairs expert with Oklahoma Independent Producers Association. You know, we've been, even though we're in both in industry, you know, both, you know, want to promote the oil and gas industry and the benefits of it, Okoga, who represents really the largest exploration production companies in Oklahoma, as well as midstream operations, refiners, have kind of been at odds with OIPA, the Small Producers Association in Oklahoma, in trying to get multi-unit drilling allowed in our statutes. It's allowed in a couple counties due to a bill that was passed a couple years ago, but we really would like it statewide. Of course, the concern with vertical producers is well bashing and, you know, accessing what, you know, sources of mineral rights that they, you know, already own. So these are hurdles that we're trying to overcome at the Oklahoma State Capitol. And glad to answer any questions later.
My name is Bobby McGill. I'm Bobby McGill,
senior science writer for Climate Central in New York. I cover fracking insofar as it releases greenhouse gas emissions. So I write a lot about methane and oil and gas development in general nationwide from a climate perspective generally. But I've been covering fracking for about a decade, starting in New Mexico and then through western Colorado and northern Colorado. And I kind of like to say that, you know, I moved into western Colorado when the Piceance Basin was really taking off, right around 2005, and it after about 2 years of covering fracking there, I took an energy and other environmental issues. I took a year off, and I came back and started working in Fort Collins, and that's when the soon after I got there, the Jake Well in Weld County became the region's first gusher as part of the Niobrara shale boom. And that really kicked it off up there, and I started writing about that. Nobody really took it very seriously. They thought that I was kind of ridiculous for writing about fracking in northern Colorado. So I kind of feel like it sort of seemed like I brought fracking to northern Colorado, but obviously that's not the case. But what I've seen over the last few years, I haven't been in Colorado for the last 2 years. But what was interesting about it is that, you know, the Niobrara shale boom in northern Colorado brought oil and gas development into residential neighborhoods, and it used to be something, or near residential neighborhoods, and it used to be something that happened out there, out on public lands, out in places where people couldn't see it. And today, it's happening near people's schools, it's happening near where people live, and whatever they call it, whether they call it fracking or drilling or whatever the term you want to use for it, they see it, they see the truck traffic, they see the plumes of dust that they're dealing with out there because of all the truck traffic and the noise and everything else, the drilling rigs lit up like Christmas trees. And that's one of the driving factors, I think, in addition to the fear of water contamination and air pollution, and ultimately the concern about the impact on climate, which is a small part of the discussion out there, I think. These things that people can see and touch are really the driving forces behind the opposition to oil and gas development in the West, in the Rockies at least. So 2 years ago, I moved to New York, and I live in the Bronx, or what amounts to the Bronx, and it's to illustrate how things are, how the issue of fracking has really penetrated into places where, you know, you wouldn't really think about where you wouldn't really think that that people would be really aware of it. I was walking out of my building a few weeks ago. I live in a 33-story high-rise on the Harlem River, and a very urban neighborhood, and I was walking along the sidewalk to go to the subway station in a very, very dense neighborhood, and on the chain link fence that separates the sidewalk from the train tracks was a big sign that says "Ban fracking now" in the Bronx. So but New York is unique because it's the only energy-rich state that has banned fracking, sort of. They haven't banned fracking outright. They have banned high volume hydraulic fracturing, which means that a well completion cannot use 300,000 gallons of water and chemicals or greater. So if it's a small frack job, go for it. So there have been some producers in Western New York that have been exploring other kinds of fracking using other gases, and I think they've explored using CO2 and propane, I believe. I don't think that's gone very far. It's, as far as I know, it's in the early stages. But New York's interesting because obviously most of, as everybody knows, the energy industry doesn't really play very prominently in its economy like it does in some of these other states. We have, you know, Wall Street and New York City and those sorts of things. So it's a bit jarring to move from Colorado, where energy is a really controversial and major part of the economy, to a place where, you know, it just the fossil fuels industry just doesn't have a foothold quite like it does elsewhere, and it's fascinating to watch. But like I said, I cover this from a climate perspective. I still write about public lands and in the West, and you know, new tar sands development in Utah and whatnot. I sit at a very interesting perch, so that's my story.
Okay, very good. Thanks, panel. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, which is great. That means we're going to have a more interactive discussion this morning. So we're all trying to wake up. I know it's 9 o'clock or 9:20 now in the morning. But as a follow-up, if you wouldn't mind, this is probably a question mostly for Adam and Mark. Would you guys give us a quick update about the status of the laws, meaning the legal cases that are going on? Both states had local bans, Denton, and then there were actually a total of 6, I think, weren't there? There were 5, okay. I guess Loveland became a legal case. It never actually became a ban. Right, before it actually became a ban. But see, if you could just quickly tell us what the status is of those cases on the legal front. Thanks.
I think I'll just project. Can you hear me if I'm just, okay. That's fine. So the state of Texas and Texoga, the industry, sued Denton the morning after we passed our ban. They had polling numbers, which we weren't aware of at the time, that showed they were gonna lose. So they were ready.
Okay.
He says I should use it, so I will use it. They were ready for it. The lawsuits, what I think was going on is that there was a great concern that the ban was actually legal under the current legislative or statutory regime. And so most of their effort didn't go into preparing for this court battle. It went into influencing the state legislature to pass a new law that would then make it clearly illegal. And then what they did with their lawsuits is they went back and referenced this new law. That then made it very, very difficult. I mean, the law made the ban unenforceable. Then the concern was that these lawsuits are potentially going to give this law a legal precedent. And so what the city council ended up doing with deep regret was actually repealing the Denton ban so as to be sure we would nullify the lawsuits. And just a month or so ago, both of those lawsuits were indeed wiped off the books, essentially. So that's where we stand now.
But the Denton ban is not in effect.
That's correct, yeah.
So, Colorado, we've had a little different item. In Longmont, 2012 ban passed. That was immediately challenged by the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, or COGA, the equivalent to OGA here. Continuing to move forward through the process. November 2013 happens. Boulder, Broomfield, Lafayette, and Fort Collins all pass, and we have moratoriums and bans go into effect in those municipalities. All but Broomfield were litigated, and a lawsuit was filed with COGA, Colorado Gas Association, with the exception of Broomfield, and that was filed later with an operator, because the language was different in all of those municipalities. At the state district court, the Longmont, Lafayette, and Fort Collins bans or moratoriums have all been overturned by the district court. Lafayette did not appeal. And the city of Lafayette decided against appealing those measures. Both Longmont and Fort Collins did, in fact, appeal. And so those have gone to the appellate court. Boulder also was ruled in favor against, and that was overturned as well in the city of Boulder. The appeals court in Colorado said this is going to end up in the Supreme Court. So the appellate system appealed the Colorado State Supreme Court to actually hear those cases, to hear Longmont and to hear Fort Collins, since they were already being appealed. About three or four weeks ago now, the Supreme Court accepted those cases, so they will not be heard at the appellate court. They're going to bypass that process and go straight to the state Supreme Court. And those oral arguments will likely be in December and January, with an expected ruling then in June. The impact that this has on Broomfield is the Broomfield language is very similar, if not identical in some of the clauses, to the Fort Collins language. So the judge has stayed that court decision until they work through the district court rulings with Fort Collins at the district court, the appellate court, and now obviously up at the state Supreme Court. So that one's a little bit different, but because it was filed later, the others were moving forward, and Broomfield was following on that same trajectory behind, but rather than move everything forward, working through that. So the lawyers and the legal team at the Colorado Oil and Gas Association are working through that. I was banned from having slides and flip charts and things. But I could draw you an organizational chart of Colorado. In a 3.5-block radius, there are 4 trade associations plus Coloradans for Responsible Energy Development for the oil and gas industry. So we all kind of have our different roles and responsibilities. We all partner together very well, but CRED, we don't have anything to do with any of the lawsuits or any of the litigation. That's all being done by the State Trade Association. We're focused on the public education, on the public outreach effort, just from an organizational perspective to give you a little insight as to what's going on in the Centennial State.
Okay, so I have a question about news coverage of drilling more broadly. And this is, again, a gathering of environmental journalists. We're very comfortable dealing with science and energy and environment. And public health is a very big part of this. Now, just a few days ago, an epidemiological study was released by Johns Hopkins University, Brown University, Cal Berkeley. These are big institutions, folks. Cal San Francisco saying that if you live within 1.5 miles, I think was their radius, of a well that is fracked, Mark, not a fracking well, you're 40% more likely to have a birth defect. It was a measure of women who had given birth, and the headline said, you know, fracking causes birth defects, right? And last night I Googled this study and came up with 3 or 4 different media studies or media reports on this study. And it wasn't until I got to the 6th one that said that the lead researcher is a fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. His name is Brian Schwartz. And he also said in the 4th paragraph of the study, we can't pinpoint why these birth defects are happening. He's also referred to fracking as a virus. Reminds me of a scene from The Matrix. So my question about the media coverage is, how do we make sense of this story, where we're dealing with a lot of stuff coming from the extremes? And how do you drill down, sorry for the metaphor, to find, you know, what's really going on and where this stuff is coming from? Bobby, why don't you start that? It's a journalist question.
So Climate Central, we view ourselves as a scientific journalism outfit. And so it's not sufficient to just, you know, talk to a study author. You have to go to the study author and sometimes 6 or 7 other scientists who are willing to review that study and provide feedback. And I think in under tight deadlines, that's often just not possible. It usually takes, you know, 7 or 8 days in some cases to nail down a lot of these sources. I think that, you know, as journalists, it's our responsibility to you know, do our jobs, which is to get as many outside sources as possible, which should go without saying. But I think a lot of times, just deadline pressure keeps people from from getting the sources they need to sort of counter.
How do you, what do you do when these kinds of media reports come out, and how do you reach out to reporters and publishers and say, hey, let's get this right?
Well, I think he's exactly right in terms of, you know, obviously, you know, your good reporters are fact-checking, asking other sources, not just the one source you may get a press release or media advisory about. But, you know, sometimes, and of course, you know, a lot of times time does not allow this, deadline doesn't allow this, but ask questions that the report didn't ask. What else is present in these areas? How long have, you know, the wells existed? If you're going to, you know, make a claim that birth defects, you know, coincide with the existence of, you know, oil and gas wells also being present. In Oklahoma, most oil and gas wells don't have a very long life. They're there maybe 36 months. So I can't imagine how, those results of birth defects tie to, you know, operating oil and gas wells. So
I'm going to take a little bit more, having not read the study or the reports that you're looking at, take a little more of a macro view, because we've had this a lot in Colorado. What we've seen is a lot of the news coverage, maybe from even some of you in this room, would go unchecked. And not that it was bad or inaccurate, but a claim would go out there, and then it was never a follow-up, again, having the point-counterpoint discussion. Even if it's a letter to the editor, an op-ed saying, hey, this was in this report, one of our experts want to have a counter to that. And over the last 24 to 25 months since we've been around, we have really made sure that we evaluate everything, really try to dig down, look through the different types of stories, Trip, that you reference, go, all right, what do we need to do to respond to this? Does it warrant a response? Does it warrant a telephone call to the reporter? We've employed, brought over Karen Crumming, who was at the Denver Post, is a longtime journalist in her career as our communications director. Very thankful to have her on our team, because she knows what you all do and the types of questions to ask and how to interact, make sure you all have the information that you need as far as the reports. So trying to arm up the reporters. And we were talking over breakfast, having a conversation, leaving nothing unchecked, and knowing that if it is wrong, we are going to call you on it. And we've had this happen. I had a prime example with the CBS affiliate in Denver. And after a local public meeting, they were standing in front of a derrick, which is the tall apparatus that does the drilling operations. I'm standing in front of this fracking tower. And at 6:30 the next morning, I called the general manager of CBS and said, all right, you got to get a retraction on this. And he's a good friend of mine. And said, no, you got to fix this, because this is flat out wrong. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, there's no such thing as a fracking tower. It doesn't exist. The technology doesn't exist. And when you frame it like, oh, okay, got it. And it's because you all want to be accurate. So making sure that you look at the technology. So we've had a lot of time. We've spent several days with journalists out in the field sharing the information, saying, all right, here's a rig tour. We're going to take you out on a frac site. We'll take you out, show you a producing rig. Want to make sure that you can ask all the questions that you can, so that in 6 months when the stories come up, you know what it is, what we're looking at. And that was very helpful from our perspective as well, to make sure that you all had armed up in your arsenal of tools, a set of information, say, hey, this is what fracking is. This is what oil and gas development in Weld County looks like with Noble or Anadarko or PDC or Whiting or whomever. I'll make sure that you all have that information. So it's been a lot of fun.
Bobby, it looks like you want to jump in on this. Yeah, go for it.
I think it's obviously it's incumbent upon all journalists to get the terminology right. But I think that, you know, fracking is the technology and the process that allows all of this oil and gas development that we're seeing today occur. And I think that the industry tends to get extraordinarily bogged down in criticizing journalists for being, and especially environmental groups and other people who are questioning the oil and gas boom. They're kind of I lost my train of thought, but they're kind of I apologize.
I'll try to save you here. You inspired me to think that one of the problems might be the word fracking itself. At least it was several years ago. The industry said they had some serious problems with it. And
right.
Is there anybody here, I'd like to see a show of hands, anybody here who works for a news organization that says they're not going to use the word fracking or they use some other kind of alternative to it? We had a debate about this at my publisher. Yeah.
I would say what Mark is trying, you know, maybe the industry is trying to redefine fracking. You know, in terms of making it, you know, by, you know, pointing out that it's a tower or the well or whatever. I mean, certainly things have to be, you know, defined correctly. But at the same time, aren't you just trying to reduce the use of the word fracking?
I'm not trying to reduce the use of the word. Want to make sure that it's used accurately. And I will tell you, I have been in the room with the senior VPs of the Rockies for all of these companies, and we have had the knockdown drag out as to how we're going to spell the word fracking. And this debate has went on for about 4 months.
There's fracing, F-R-A-C-I-N-G,
there's hydrofracing.
F-R-C apostrophe ing. I love that one. I've never seen an apostrophe used that way before, by the way.
and we looked at it and said, guys, you don't ask me how to drill a well, or dear God, I hope you don't ask me how to drill a well because I have no idea how to do it. But I also don't ask you how to engage the public. And we did a lot of research. In Colorado, 88% of Coloradans knew the word fracking spelt with a K. When you're dealing with brand awareness, no matter what you're looking at, you cannot take something at an 88% brand awareness rate and change the word.
And to be fair, it's the industry that started spelling it that way. You guys have been spelling it with a K for a very long time. There are some exceptions. Frack Tracker, for example, out of Pennsylvania, uses FRAC Tracker, and they have a very long explanation for why they do that. Mainly because
Frack Focus is without a K, isn't it?
That is correct.
That is right.
Carolyn.
Carolyn Wetzel with Bloomberg BNA. I have a question for Arnella. You're talking about the, I think it was legislation, SB 809. It has a provision that that defines health and safety.
Actually, it didn't define health and safety.
It didn't.
That was the only thing, the only power that municipalities have in terms of banning operations is in order to protect public health and safety.
And so are you looking, is there an effort underway to define exactly what that health and
safety
impact is?
That's what the questions that were submitted to our attorney general are.
Okay.
What does that mean?
Okay.
Is there precedent in other oil and gas statutes that defines when, you know, regulatory things can intervene because of public health and safety? And in fact, in one of our oil and gas title, we actually do have a couple instances, and in an emergency of public health and safety, our state regulatory body can intervene. But we're waiting on what that might mean for municipalities.
But if once it's defined, then municipalities would have the authority, their own power to intervene.
And we actually have, Stillwater and Norman today have passed regulations. Now, in some instances, the industry, you know, there might be, you know, it's 3 pages of regulations, there might be one subsection that industry doesn't like. So, you know, they're still debating on well setbacks and, you know, how much is too much in terms of, you know, still allowing operations to happen. So we have municipalities already passing ordinances, even though this bill has passed. Now, the problem will be that legal definition of what far is, you know, how far is too far going beyond public health and safety and basically an in effect ban via regulation.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess, can I ask another question?
Yeah,
okay. Okay. You know, one of the things, I'm based in California, and one of the things that has happened is there has been a real boon of local initiatives, either by city council or county supervisors, or even to impose bans, and some in places that don't even have any oil and gas development, but then a lot of these lawsuits that have happened on the East in the Marcellus Shale and Colorado have really put a damper on local government approval of these bans because they don't want to go through the expense of litigation. And I guess I have that question for Adam. Is this what is happening in Texas? Is that local communities just don't want to fight the handle the legal cost of this?
So I think that is the broad strategy of the industry, is to utilize their resources, which are greater than grassroots groups, to drag them through endless court battles, and also to influence legislatures like in Texas to make the bar extremely high for a local ordinance to be found valid. So I do think that that's going on, essentially.
And isn't that something that you hear local government? I covered a city council hearing in Boulder, Colorado, and one of the city council members, this was a couple iterations ago, said the reason why he was going to vote no on the, it wasn't a full ban, but it was some type of a restrictive thing, was he said specifically because I do not want Boulder to get sued. So, I mean, there probably is some fear or concern about that among locals.
Oh, there's definitely, and that was the biggest, you know, the industry spent $1 million fighting our ban, and we had $75,000, and most of the money was, we're going to sue you, you guys are going to lose your shorts on this. And the other one was, you're going to lose so much economic productivity.
Right.
And I don't think either was actually the case, but it is a good fear-mongering strategy. We actually wrote a really smart ordinance that in its details, I think, put it squarely within our authority, and we were able to make the case to our voters that that was true. But then, of course, they went and changed the rules after the vote.
Very good. We have some other questions. So back here. Mike?
Hi, Mike Sorahan with Energy Wire. Mark, you started off with a point about, you know, precision in language, talking about, you know, the term fracking and being misused. And then you in my mind, kind of jumped and talked about there being so much misinformation. And it sounded like you were saying that the concerns of the public out there are really misinformation, and I'm wondering if you think that there are, and the I guess primarily to the two industry people on the panel, are there legitimate public health and safety concerns that people have, and are they really fully addressed by the, you know, general regulatory structure we have in the states right now?
It's a great question. I think there are general and legitimate concerns on health and safety, and people bring these up on a regular basis. And there's a number of studies, including recent studies that have been released by the EPA on air and water quality and linking there. As far as the regulations are concerned, you know, Colorado has done a masterful job. And I know Oklahoma, you know, maybe even to a little bit, we've frustrated Oklahoma with the amount of regulations that we've put in there with our air quality and our water quality testing. You know, we're first in the country on looking at water quality testing before and after drilling. First in the country with methane rules and regulations that have been in place. And that was an agreement early last year between a number of operators in Colorado, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the governor's office. All of that said, those regulations are great. Yeah, they help provide that. Unless you're a wonk, and you know, the general public isn't going to know what those regulations are. They're not going to know that they exist. The COGCC has a 50% unawareness rate in the state, not a disapproval rate. Half of Coloradans have never heard of the state regulatory agency that deals with these items. So again, that's why, all right, from a public awareness side, how do we increase that awareness to Coloradans to make sure, A, here's how you can get the answers to your questions that are very, very legitimate. When you're seeing, you know, heavy truck traffic and you know, down your roads, the dust, the noise, things of that nature, how do you do that? And the companies have also gone the extra mile to say, hey, we're going to go and knock on your door. And Anadarko does this a lot. They're on the south end of the Wattenberg Basin, so they're much closer to the Denver metropolitan area than some other operators that are north and east of the Wattenberg field. And they'll go door to door if they're going to go and be drilling adjacent to a community and leave flyers saying, all right, here's the timeline of what's going to happen. And if you have questions, here's an 800 number that you can call 24 hours a day, and we will get back to you very quickly. If they don't have someone live to answer that phone at that time, we'll get back to you right away with your concern. So the companies themselves also are now going the extra mile to make sure that those communities where people are, where they're operating in, know what is actually going on.
Arnella, did you want to jump in on that?
And I would say, I mean, in Oklahoma, our committees have always done that. I mean, because of
real close to the mic, if you can, yeah.
Because of personal property rights issues in Oklahoma, the oil and gas industry has always had a struggle to somewhat with landowners. So I would say your good actors have always, tried to be proactive in talking to landowners. In Oklahoma, kind of the local drilling regulation started because of a bad actor in Stillwater, didn't communicate with the adjacent homeowner and, started activity right behind their back door. That's really what started to cause, furor in that community. In terms of, kind of to back up a little bit, the concern about misinformation being spread, I mean, that is not your, that's not the journalism community. That's Hollywood. That is, television shows that, kind of use extreme messages or, flat out falsehoods.
The Rolling Stones have a song that has an anti-fracking lyric.
It's popular culture that, is influencing the misinformation among the general public that doesn't understand the industry. I mean, I wouldn't say that's journalists. If you have an opportunity, and you have companies that will invite you to their facility so you can learn more, take that opportunity. The problem is when there is a crisis, their legal advisors will generally not allow them to answer your questions. I mean, I know that's frustrating, but even as a trade association for them, there's a lot of times we can't get information because legal advisors have said, nope, we're not, it's proprietary, we can't share it. So it's not that the company is unwilling to share information. There, a lot of times the attorneys stop that from happening. So.
We've got several other questions I want to give everybody
on,
a chance.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Trip. Hold on. I just wanted to add to that real quick. The thing about Colorado is there is a lot of data that's available online, and while it is one of the more heavily regulated oil and gas states, Colorado has a fairly vast database of spill and release information. And, whether people realize how well regulated the state is, they still see all these, they still understand that, the oil and gas industry has permanently changed their neighborhoods. And then they hear about all of these spills and releases and they have access to this data and they don't know exactly what that means. And I think, if you know that there have been several thousand releases, oil and gas related spills and releases in a certain region over the course of a year, that can scare people. And I think, just from where I sit, probably rightly so. But I think, when we talk about misinformation, I think there's lack of information more than misinformation, at least, when it comes to transparency, even though there's a vast amount of information available, there's not enough people interpreting what that means for the public.
So drilling down real quickly on the Stillwater case. So Stillwater has a bad operator, causes problems. There's a rule in Stillwater. The answer to this apparently is for the state to wipe out any control at the level of Stillwater. So what has happened with that operator and how is that a better situation?
So the Stillwater proposal for municipal ordinance coincided with our state legislative session. And so in fact, in Oklahoma, it was industry, our Oklahoma Municipal League, which represents, it's a trade association for our cities and towns, the general counsel for the city of Stillwater and the general counsel for city of Norman, really throughout the legislative session met and worked together to develop Senate Bill 8009, which I think is why it really passed pretty easily. The frustration by the local legislator that represented Stillwater was because of this bad actor. So, I mean, he was really, probably the lone voice opposing Senate Bill 809 that would have stopped excessive regulations by municipalities. So in Oklahoma, really, I mean, we just are pretty good about all sides working together because we've seen when we fight with landowners, when we fight, that usually does not get a good result for anybody. It is a very small operator, so I mean, I'm just not on the ground in Stillwater. I apologize, I don't know.
Okay, we got a couple more questions here, right here.
Hi, this is Jim Bruggers. I'm a reporter with the Courier Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. First of all, just as a point of potential clarification, that study that Johns Hopkins that you mentioned about birth defects, I did a quick little check here, and it talks about actually premature birth, not birth defects, and that may be something that we ought to pay a little attention to. But anyway, I'm just starting to see like the first two or three test wells in Kentucky, and I'm just wondering, and there may be this happening in other states too, and I'm just wondering what's the current price of oil and gas and how does that affect the expansion of this opportunity or challenge in other parts of the country, and how quickly is that likely to kind of spread?
In Oklahoma, we have some very efficient operators. In fact, we have one company that can get a barrel of oil out of the ground for $2 a barrel. So they're even at, you know, $36, $40 a barrel oil, they still have pretty good profit margins. I mean, they just have figured out how to utilize, you know, all the best technology available to them. Of course, they're operating in a part of Oklahoma that is not in the area of interest in terms of the extra regulations our operators face if earthquakes have been happening. Where the geology, where they happen to be operating, it's almost like one-to-one barrel of oil with produced water. And so when they are injecting the water back into the ground, just the geography of that part of the state, I mean, soaks up the water immediately. So in terms of, like, we've got operators in the area of interest who, you know, they have, like, 200 barrels of water compared to one barrel of oil, which is a big problem when we're reducing injection volumes. So part of it is just depending on where you're operating in the state, how efficient and what profit margins you can make. So that geology and geography factors in there. Yes, about other states.
Hi, I'm Judy Faze, KUER, Utah Public Radio in Salt Lake City. One of the things that I have a bit of trouble with is getting numbers that are not squishy on a lot of different levels. One is as simple as what the activity is in our state. Another one is on health and safety data. And another is on economic impacts. And I have a follow-up, but can each of you, or maybe a few of you, talk about where are reliable sources of information those places might be? So we're talking about activity in the industry, health and safety, and economics. Where are your go-to sources to learn more about what's really happening?
Well, it depends on what state we're talking about, obviously. If we want to look at a national perspective, the Energy Information Administration is a good source. Frac Focus, obviously, is another source for hydraulic fracturing data. It's not complete necessarily, but it's a pretty darn good view of fracking nationwide. Every state is different when it comes to reporting, oil and gas activity and the environmental impacts. As I mentioned earlier, Colorado has a very extensive database, and I think Utah doesn't have much at all. It's been a while since I've looked at Utah's data, but Utah is certainly one of those states where, you know, transparency is a challenge. The catch with a lot of this, and I don't know about a lot of other states, but in Colorado, most of, say, the environmental impact data, the spills and releases and various other things, they're industry reported oftentimes. And so you have to take a lot of that with a little bit of a grain of salt. I mean, it's the operators themselves who are reporting what the exact volume was of a certain oil spill or condensate spill or whatever. It requires a little bit more footwork than just to report what a spill report says. But like I said, every state is different. Last time I checked, I don't know if this is still true, but I think Texas actually charged for that information. It really is a checkerboard of transparency across the country.
Yeah, could I just weigh in? I'm not going to answer your question. I'm just going to increase your muddle, because it sounds like you're asking, where are the facts? And a lot of this has been this kind of thing. I don't think this is about facts at all. This is about hermeneutics. This is about interpretation. We've heard that there's not enough information. We've heard that there's misinformation. But I just want to provoke you into thinking maybe there's too much information. Because what can happen, like this Johns Hopkins study, is what's going to happen? I can predict it. Somebody's going to be able to find in that study something that promotes their cause. And they're going to say, if I was you, I would say, correlation is not causation. Right? And if I was in Earthworks or Food and Water Watch, I would just say premature births, right? And so there's going to be two interpretations of one study going on. Let me give you another example. The Denton fracking ban will cost the local economy $5 million. There's a fact for you. Came from the Perryman Group, which is an independent group, but they use a proprietary economic methodology. All numbers are constructions. There's something that has to go into it to make that number. In this case, we don't know how they arrived at that number, but I used whatever data I could find from the industry to actually make the case that the Denton fracking ban will grow the local economy. What do you do in the face of that as a reporter? I don't know, but I would suggest that your jobs maybe shouldn't be just, I mean, I agree, sometimes there's facts, right? I'm not a total constructivist, but facts are oftentimes constructions. There's something behind it. I think your job should be to uncover what went into the construction of that fact and whose interests were involved in making it. You know, that's what I like when I read a really good story. Somebody digs into that.
I do. Did you want to
just give one brief comment? And Bobby makes a very good point as far as, you know, kind of the industry, you know, self-reporting and looking at it. And we at CRED and our team have looked at kind of, all right, how do we get away from citing Western Energy Alliance, COGA, API, and drive down? You know, we have an entire research section, and I would encourage you to look at it on CRED.org. But we link to all of the primary documents themselves. So the studies, whether it's from Interior or EPA or CU Lead School of Business, I think on the economic data, this is one that we've actually tried to find as well. It's often lagging behind, at least in Colorado. I know of two CU Lead School of Business reports that have come out, and both of them are available on our website. We've got a link directly to the study itself. So we try to go, all right, how do, you know, when you all are looking for information, we got to make sure it's the right type of information, because if it's just, you know, as Bobby said, if it's coming from the oil and gas industry, you got to take it with a grain of salt versus, no, this is, according to Gina McCarthy at the Environmental Protection Agency, former administrator, da-da-da-da-da. That's the way we look at it.
And to be fair, there are some of those oil and gas-related studies have been heavily funded by the industry, so you might have to do some further investigation.
Okay,
as well.
And then the follow-up is, for each of you, really quickly, what is the biggest or the best uncovered story that you're aware of, that we should be looking at? What's the story no one's telling that needs to be told right now?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't really know, but I think this story about science and fracking is a really interesting untold story, and I think it ties into this proactionary approach that I'm talking about. Because once you set up a system where the technology is innocent until proven guilty, and then you have what I call an excess of objectivity. Now, it's not my term, actually. The great STS scholar says we have an excess of objectivity out there, which is every time there's a study, there are people picking and cherry-picking and saying, this proves my point, this proves my point, to see how the politics of fracking has become scientized. You know, I think I'd pitch a story to you like this. We are in a new phase of fracking politics. At first, you could say there wasn't enough information, and we're using people in Texas like guinea pigs. But now I think there's like 20,000 studies out there, and there's great myth that somehow science is going to compel political action. Still is a myth because it hasn't happened. Why is that? Well, now maybe it's not that there's not enough information. Maybe it's that we have this excess of objectivity going on, and that there's too much. Right, something like that.
Yeah, the original question was, what do you think is the big story out there? What should we be covering?
I would say, ma'am, to your question, and also the good gentleman from Louisville as well, looking at the downturn that we're in right now and the evolution of the technology and the continued commitment to R&D and what companies are able to do to make sure, all right, what's economical, And how do we increase and continue to expand and look at the further development? I mean, this is how we, in 2007, 2008, got horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing together. All right, what's going to be the next one that will tie not only into your story, but also, sir, into is this going to be viable in Kentucky?
So kind of along the same lines in terms of where is activity going to continue in various states, it comes down to cost. We have operators that They have been operating in North Dakota, but they've moved their operations to Oklahoma because of the tax changes in North Dakota. Taxes are a cost. Regulatory imposition is a cost. So, you know, rigs can move. They can get on a truck and they can go anywhere. Drilling rigs can move. So that's what's going to dictate where people are operating in the United States, because they can. We've had people, in fact, Alaska, when they had a tax fight a few years ago, we had Alaskan companies come to Oklahoma because it was cheaper to do business here. In terms of the untold story, you know, I think, you know, I go to various, you know, national conference, state legislatures, those types of things. One of the presentations that I saw that I think is forgotten is how petroleum products touch our lives in very small ways and very big ways. I mean, the hairspray I used this morning, the pens you're riding with, the cell phones you use, all of those have petroleum products in them. And if the United States continues down this path of imposing unnecessary regulations, basically trying to stop development of fossil fuels, everything in our life will get more expensive. Not just traveling, not just driving up and down the highway, but all types of products that we purchase if we have to rely on international sources for oil and natural gas products.
Say this is not an untold story, but it's an undercovered story. The role of public lands as a solution to climate change and the role of public lands in climate policy and fracking and fossil fuels development play heavily into that.
Okay, we have a question right over here.
Thank you. Thank you. Don Hopi from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Started covering fracking back in 2007 or maybe 2008, and that was the last time that I actually was invited onto a fracking a well that was being fracked. The company that invited me actually had a tent and served cookies to the various media people. And I can't believe Bobby hasn't picked up on this, but you're talking about transparency, Mark and Arnella. We've had a lot of trouble with SCJ getting onto drill sites and places where they were fracking was going on. We had trouble in Texas. We were turned away in Louisiana. We didn't get on a site here in Oklahoma. My question is, how can we get on drilling sites and talk about fracking with people that are doing the jobs? Arnella?
I mean, I can't speak to operators in your home state. I would say we certainly have willing companies in Oklahoma. I would say the problem right now, we're trying to set up a legislative tour for a rig tour. The hardest part right now is finding an active rig. So that might, you know, today that might be a problem. Those active rigs are, you know, much fewer than they were a year ago this time. So that's one issue right now. But our Oklahoma companies, I know they take, though I will say, I know they've taken press in the middle of the summer. In Oklahoma, it's not very fun when you have to wear all the safety gear being on a well site, but we've had willing, not every company in Oklahoma is willing, but our large E&P companies have certainly been willing to do that for press, legislators, regulators, you name it, in our state.
And again, I can't speak to other operators in other states. I know we've had numerous companies in Colorado that have taken press out. I have a pocket full of business cards. Please feel free to grab one from me afterwards and happy to set that up. You know, it might require travel to Colorado if I don't have operations or no operators in other states, but definitely in Colorado I can help. Again, we don't do them often, but a couple of times a year we do have taken them out on rigs, and it's a great tour.
Just want to chime in on that. I have led the fracking tours at SCJ co-led the fracking tours at SCJ for the last 3 years, and I'd have to say that this is the most access here in Oklahoma that we've had, and also the last two states we visited didn't have a lot of oil and gas that was available to us anyway, but at least on shore. But one of the issues last year in New Orleans was, you know, in Encana, we had to go through Doug Hawk at Encana in Colorado to try to get access to a well in Mississippi, and they were all about it for a while, and then they realized, oh, we've got 50 journalists who want to go and, you know, check out one of our drilling rigs and or well sites, and you know, he talked to his superiors, and they're like, no, sorry, we just don't want journalists snooping around on well sites. And this is something that before I moved to New York, I actually did get an off-the-record tour of a fracking site from a very, very tiny operator, and I don't remember who it was off the top of my head, but he was telling me that all of the all of his colleagues in the industry were telling him never talk to the press because they're basically out to screw us. There's an obvious bias and fear among operators to talk to anybody in the press for that reason, because it's obviously not good PR. And I don't know what it is. There was nothing on the off the record tour of the fracking operation that I saw that was immediately obvious as incriminating necessarily, other than, you know, people may misinterpret what it is they're seeing. But I think from a reporting perspective and from a journalistic perspective, it makes us very suspicious of what the industry is trying to hide if we don't have any access at all. And so far, that's been our experience.
Well, just to rebut on that just very briefly, operator by operator, and they all do things very, very differently, and I work with about 20 of them on a daily basis, very large E&Ps in Colorado. But looking at the access that they've got, we have spent, and the team that I work with at CRED, have spent 2 years with these operators going, guys, you have got to demystify this. And to your point, be able to open it up and have the conversations. And they're finally getting there and willing to do so. Not every operator is comfortable with that, and all completely agree to that. But there are a lot who are willing to do so. But it's, all right, how do we do that? Because they've got to take their guys off of their day jobs to have tour guides and things. But again, I encourage you to please reach out either to myself or to Ornella to help set one of those up and try to drive that discussion.
The paranoia among operators, can I just add? The paranoia among operators in Colorado, and I'm sure elsewhere, is pretty extreme. I was in Western Colorado about 2.5 years ago, right before I moved to New York, working on a completely unrelated story. This was after the Parachute Creek spill, which was pretty significant. I was telling you about this the other day. I was driving along Highway 6, parallel to I-70 near Parachute, and I was trying to take pictures of the Colorado River because I was working on a story about the Colorado River Basin. And Williams, I don't know what its official name is right now, but because they've merged several times, but Representative Williams drove up to me on a public right-of-way and said, you can't take pictures here because there's a well nearby, and we're going to call the cops on you if you don't move. And I tried to tell him off and told him to go away, but he was very insistent. And it's this level of intimidation that we see. I don't know if that happens every day. It's only happened once to me, but there's definitely a level of paranoia out there that affects the transparency and the available information.
Just a quick follow-up. Actually, it's kind of in a different direction, but it does follow up on the intimidation issue. These are legal questions. I was really intrigued by the commercially reasonable standard and wondering in House Bill 40, and wondering what standard that replaced. And secondly, which is kind of different, I was wondering if you've seen in Texas an increase in slap suits. We've seen certain slap suits, strategic lawsuit against public participation in Pennsylvania, and I was wondering if you're seeing that in Texas and Oklahoma.
I don't know the second question well enough to answer on the slap suits. The first one is, what did the commercially reasonable standard replace? Is really a more of a case law tradition, and it didn't have a name, so I called it the community reasonable standard. And what I mean by that is that deference to local regulators, that they know what's best in the interest of their citizens. And so you see this track record of local communities beating the industry in the court system. And I mean, that's my understanding of the legal history of shared governance in Texas. And, you know, in HB 40, it says that cities were always impliedly preempted from doing the sorts of things they're doing. But I don't think that's true, because we were doing it and getting court recognition for doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. We probably have time for two more questions. We have one right over here.
Hi, I'm Denise from Media Matters, Denise Robbins. And I was wondering, we often see, this question is for Mark and Arnella, we often see a talking point about, in response to methane regulations and water safety regulations, that the industry has a financial incentive to regulate themselves. And so there shouldn't be any federal regulations because the industry can take care of it on their own. But in the past month, we have both the Volkswagen emissions scandal, where they cheated to emit higher than they said that they were, and the indictment of Don Blankenship, who knowingly had unsafe coal mines. So in light of these recent events, like, how can the public be sure, how can they trust that the industry is going to regulate themselves, even though it might not have been their financial interest to do so?
Well, in Oklahoma, our talking point has been, our Oklahoma regulators know what's best. They know Oklahoma's geology and geography, the history of our water resources, better than the EPA does. So in Oklahoma, we do rely on our state regulators and trust them to do the right job, whether that's Oklahoma Corporation Commission, our Department of Environmental Quality, or Oklahoma Water Resources Board for permitting water uses. Our concern is when the EPA, who does not know Oklahoma's history, does not know our geology or geography, wants to come in and dictate things.
For me and CRED, I don't handle regulations or deal with any of the regulatory affairs items in Colorado or at the federal level on behalf of the companies I represent, so I'm really unfortunately not able to answer that question. I hate dodging it, but that's the only one prior today that I won't be able to answer.
Oh, fair dodge. Fair.
And then you brought up a couple companies. Those companies are already violating regulations that are in place. I'm not sure of the talking point that's out there where companies want to regulate themselves. To bring up companies that they just got caught, violating rules that were already in place. So.
Great. Folks, we are at 10:17. We're over time. I want to ask you all to say thanks to the panel for an excellent discussion. And if you guys wouldn't mind to hang around for a little bit, if anybody has any follow-ups or any other questions, but thank you very much for your time and enjoy the rest of today's meeting. Yet.